I hope you have had a chance to watch that third presentation by Steve Jobs. I watched it again. I think it's quite interesting. He's saying really important things about his career, his life. And he's pointing out a few things that definitely are happening in everybody's life, like coincidences. The topic for today is writing research articles. As you remember from the first class, it's a very important skill, one of the most important, although all of them are important, but this is one of the most important, because when writing, you are communicating whatever findings you've had. So today, about writing, how do we do it? First, motivation. Why is this an important skill? Why we should bother to write? Then, composition of a research article. So what's in it? What should be in an article? How we should write it? And then a little bit about the process of writing. So how do you sit down and start and write? Hello. Please see me after the class. I'll check you. So why do we need to write? The important thing is we want to communicate others, tell others about our findings, our research results. We contribute to the growing body of knowledge in science, and if we don't write it, if we don't communicate it, people will not even know about it. The second reason, I think, is that we want to be criticized. Not because we are masochists, but because critique makes our work better in the long run. So the more criticism we get, the better. And what if we are wrong? The earlier we get the criticism, the earlier we realize we are wrong, the better. Because otherwise, you know, we advance, and then too late, people will tell us that we are wrong, and we will fall from a big height. So we want to know it as soon as possible. Like in the cult movie, The Godfather, if you remember the scene when consigliere Tom Hagen goes to Hollywood and he, the movie Big Shot says no, he says, if you could please arrange a taxi to the airport because Mr. Corleone wants to hear bad news as soon as possible. Really, we want to hear it as early as possible. And then, third reason is really selfish. We want to get recognition for our work. No. Selfish because we want people to recognize us, to know how to spell our name, to associate our name, to recognize it. If they do, we'll get more money because it's going to be easier to get grant money. People will invite us, give us honoris causa degrees, etc., etc., maybe prizes like Nobel Prize. So we really want to get recognition, and that's a selfish reason. If there was no third point, then, you know, from the point of view of the world, everything would be fine. Of course, we deserve it. If we've done a lot of good work, we deserve to be recognized. Because if we are consistently right, it's good that they are giving us money to do research, that they publish us. So if we are recognized as good scientists, we get more resources, our career is going to be developing better. So there's three reasons we should write. Typically, writing closes up a cycle of investigation. You will notice, the first thing, you already have experience with writing your master's thesis or bachelor's thesis. You got a topic, you worked on it for 6 months, maybe 10 months, maybe 12 months, and then at the end, you wrote it up, defended it, and finished that part of your life. The same with your doctorate. You got a topic, you are thinking about this, you are going to work on it. At the end, you will defend it and you get a doctorate. This thing will happen over and over when you are a grown-up scientist, as I would say. You have an idea, you work on it, you work it out, You write it up, publish it, and then get to a new idea, right? So it closes a certain cycle. Those cycles are going to be shorter than your dissertation, of course. Typically, you will have 1, 2, maybe 3 papers, good papers a year. If you are very productive, maybe 3. If you are less productive, 1 or 2. Less productive doesn't mean worse. If you have really very good ideas, 1 paper a year is going to be very good, actually. It may give you the highest rewards if these are really good ideas. In any case, it closes up a cycle. The problem, of course, is not very easy because you spent a lot of time on it. You have on the idea. You have a lot of thoughts about this. You want to say many things. And then you need to summarize it in a short paper, depending on where you publish it. A journal paper typically is between 10 and 20 pages. A conference paper has more strict limitation, 6 pages, 8 pages, or 10 pages, depending on the conference. The quality conference is usually 6 to 10 pages. So you have to summarize it. It's not easy. Why do we need to do it well? Because having a good idea and producing very good results is not enough. There's this philosophical problem. I don't think it's philosophy of science. I think it's philosophy in general. If a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to hear it, does it still make a noise? Right? The same with us. If nobody knows what you've done, the impact is going to be very small on science and on your personal career. So you should definitely write it up and publish it. And there are many papers that are poorly written, really many. If you already have experience with that already, I'm sure. You've read papers that are difficult to read, that are not well written, that are poorly written. And I don't mean the language. We just, in a seminar, we had this short discussion that science is biased towards the English language. yes, it is, but because science, English has become more or less the language that we use in science worldwide. So if you don't know how to write in English, you are, in a way, handicapped. It's much easier to do everything when you learn English. Is it a bias? I guess, you know, it's a skill. You have to learn it. There is really no choice. So I don't mean really the language even. I mean the structure, the way they summarize things. We will talk about this. Many papers are poorly written. And good writing is a skill. You can learn it. It's not that you are born a good writer. Sometimes we hear somebody speak or write and we think, wow, boy, this lady was born a writer. So I imagine a baby, you know, she was just born and she already was able to write. Of course, that's impossible. She had to learn it. And we can learn. We can learn to write well. And it's worth to learn it because in the long run, you'll get more credit, more money, and more papers accepted. Because people will recognize your name. Oh, another paper from this scientist, we know it. He or she is good, so it's going to be easier to get through the reviews and acceptance. And your results will have more impact, so more impact on science. Again, good. Some papers belong in a Journal of Obscure Research. I think that name is a joke, but there is a real Journal of Irreproducible Results. Of course, that name is very funny because in science, whatever you produce, you want it to be reproducible. It cannot be just, you know, you did something and by stroke of luck, it came out one way that you wanted. It has to be reproducible. So whatever results you have, you want it to be other people to be able to reproduce it so that it's a genuine, real result. And that is a real journal. It has a lot of really funny papers, worth looking at just for fun if you want to see something funny. And the joke is about an intimidating title, I guess. It's a very popular comics in the US, I think it's an American comics.
Calvin and Hobbes.
Calvin and Hobbes, yes. Most people know it. And especially doctoral students love that. This is a very important slide. You know, there's always, in every presentation, there are a small number of really important slides. This one is very important. It says essentially that the main purpose of a paper that you write is to communicate an idea, one idea. The idea should be explicit, it should be well described, understandable, it should be made clear in the very beginning of the paper, and supported throughout the paper. It should be one idea. If you have, what do you do when you have multiple ideas? Well, you write multiple papers, right? One for every idea. Sometimes people want to cram several ideas in one paper. Occasionally, it may make sense. The ideas are very related. But typically, think about it as one idea, one paper. If you have multiple ideas, write several papers. Here's a series of four slides that I saw. These are not the original slides. I made them up. But that was communicated to me when I was still before my doctoral studies. I finished my master's degrees and I wanted to see a little bit of the world. So I wrote 10 letters to different places in the world, Japan, United States, you know, all kind of well-developed countries, and asking if I can spend a few months there. And I got a few offers. I got an offer of a desk in Japan without any money. I got a stipend, I think, at Stanford from somebody, and I got an offer from IBM Watson Center, which is one of the biggest, it used to be one of the biggest research centers in computer science, with a real salary, and they needed my skills. And in that time, I wanted to spend 6 months there, but I spent actually 1 year and 6 months there, which was very interesting. I'm a very curious person. I did a lot of things. I was shooting guns. There was a gun club at IBM. But there were also seminars, and seminars were interesting. I was kind of thinking about the idea of doing a PhD. One talk was by a famous guy. I knew his name. Harold Stone, still remember the name. He was well known in the domain of computer architecture. And he gave a talk on writing papers for colleagues at IBM Research Center. I thought, wow, this is interesting. So I went there. And the next four slides are more or less, it's his idea, Harold Stone. So he wrote, he said the following. When you read a suspense novel, let's say Agatha Christie or Arthur Conan Doyle, you read something like that. On page one, it was a stormy night. On page four, you read that they found a dead body. You don't know yet whose body it is, but it was a dead body during that stormy night. You realize it was a murder because there was a knife in the back of that person, right? Suspense is building. On page 10, you realize that it was Mr. Henry Jones, a prominent landlord in, I always get it wrong, the pronunciation of that name, but I think it's Worcestershire or something. You know, it's on purpose a complicated name to make the suspense even grow even bigger. Page 58, you read, victim's sister and brother-in-law had a motive, inheritance. And so did the son of the victim. Page 128, Sherlock Holmes, who was called to investigate that, noticed that the dog did not bark. What does it tell you? It told to Mr. Holmes that it was an insider job, because the dog would not bark on the insider. Sherlock Holmes hides in the bushes, sets up a
he makes the doer come there in the middle of the night, jumps out, beats him up, and catches the murderer, the butler. And then further, the butler hated the victim because he was insulted by the victim. That's the end. The butler is caught, everything's done. So what do you notice? Notice that the suspense is building. The pleasure of reading is very nice because as you read, you long for reading more. You really want to read more. Suspense. A scientific paper describing the whole thing would sound like this. Mr. Henry Jones of Worcestershire was murdered by his butler. The murder was discovered by Sherlock Holmes. That's in the abstract. That's the pleasure of reading is completely spoiled, isn't it? Then, in the introduction, you read that Mr. Henry Jones, a prominent landlord in Worcestershire, was murdered by his butler. The murder was discovered by Sherlock Holmes. The crucial element of the discovery was noticing that the dog did not bark. Hence, it must have been an insider. Two things. More details, of course. More spoilers. The pleasure of reading is spoiled already. But also some repetition. You notice that in the abstract we say everything, but in the introduction we say more of that everything. Then you keep reading. The middle of the paper, exact time and course of murder, description of the murder weapon, the knife, the people at whom the dog would not bark because Sherlock Holmes had to eliminate the others. Other people who benefited from the death of the victims or the motives, etc. Methodology and results, a description of the deduction steps taken by Sherlock Holmes, the role of Dr. Watson, who always asks stupid questions, but then helps Mr. Holmes in catching the murderer, a trap that he set up to catch the murderer. Discussion, description of how the observed evidence suggested that it was the butler, related work, similar murders and related discoveries, work performed by Holmes, and conclusion, a brief restatement of everything that is important. So what do we notice that here? This is a very important slide, kind of summarizing what Harold Stone wanted to communicate. There should never be suspense in a scientific paper at any given point. Everything should be clear. Never should there be a thought, well, I wonder, what's next, right? It should be all told very clearly from the very beginning. Never any suspense at any given point. So that's the idea that Harold so communicated. I kind of remember that for forever, actually. I think it's an important idea. Sometimes when you read a paper, this is violated, and it's not good. This is also important, this idea, that a paper, like any good writing, should tell an interesting story. So even if you read Agatha Christie or Sherlock Holmes, you read a story. Of course, in scientific writing, there should be no suspense, but it still should be a good story. It's like presentations. We'll talk about presentations probably next week. Look at people who present. Look at many of you are probably going to churches, synagogues, or mosques, whatever your religion is. You hear sermons. People are telling a story, or if you hear a speaker or maybe a lecture. When is it good? It's good when it tells a consistent story. You know that there can be very boring speakers. Very good speakers tell a good story. And the same thing should be with the paper. It should tell an interesting story. You're writing for people, and you need to make sure that they follow you. You really want to communicate your idea, so you want them to understand the idea, really follow you. You start with the general, the things that are familiar to the reader, and then you proceed with new ideas and details. The entire paper should be well organized into this story. Good organization. Transition between sections and paragraphs should be also clear and gentle. It should be a cohesive story, the whole thing. Of course, no suspense, but a good story, like you saw in case of Mr. Watson and Dr. Watson and Mr. Holmes. I've seen that slide somewhere, so it's not originally my idea. I've seen this somewhere. Maybe I wrote it myself, but I've seen it somewhere. Kind of putting together the paper and what should be happening in the reader's mind. I thought it was a very nice way of putting it. So you write in your paper, here is a problem, cancer. The problem is interesting. So one way or another, you should motivate why the problem is interesting. Well, people are dying. That makes the problem interesting. You would like to save their lives. The reader should, at that point, think, well, that's a good problem, really. Good problem, well identified. The problem is hard and unsolved. You describe that other people were trying and they didn't get to solve it. The reader should at that point think, well, I wish I knew how to solve it. If I knew, I would get Nobel Prize or whatever. So the reader should be interested. Good problem, hard to solve. I wish I knew how to do it. Here's my idea. And you describe your idea, describe what it is, the details, that the idea works. You can support your claim with theoretical proofs or hard data describing in the paper. The reader should see how it works and have this idea, wow, this is really smart, ingenious, very good idea. Of course, you cannot... there's this saying, even Solomon cannot pour water from an empty jar. Of course, if your idea is not that great, you cannot make it into a wonderful, great idea. But I assume that you will have in your work good ideas. So this is the way you should present them. The reader should see that it's a good idea. And later, here is how my idea compares to other people's approaches, because there were other people probably trying to solve it. So you should also have that part. Another thing is when you look at your paper, these are typical sections in your paper. Of course, it depends on the discipline. The length are kind of orientational, more or less. The section titles may be slightly different, although most scientific papers, all papers have titles. Which are very important titles, and thousands of readers, people read it, because they see the table of content of a paper, they see an announcement on the web, a new issue of Nature appears, here are the papers, so you see the titles and authors, for example. Many people will see it. People who go occasionally to libraries to look at journals, they will see the titles in the table of content. Abstract, usually it's a few sentences, four, five, can be six also, right? But more or less a few sentences. Hundreds of readers. Why hundreds? Well, the title got their interest. Out of the few thousands, a few hundred read the abstract to see if it is of interest to them. Introduction. Typically, also people read it. Introduction is short, one page, sometimes two pages, also hundreds of readers. The problem, the exact description, typically tens of readers. Those who went through the introduction, who got interested, please note that the number of people reading gets smaller. Your idea, again, tens of readers. The tens of readers are people who are interested working in the same field, the same area. The details are read by single readers, just a handful, a few people. Related work, one or two pages, Again, it's going up, tens of readers. Conclusions and further work, short, again, tens of readers. Why? Why tens of readers? Suddenly, the number of readers is growing. So they are reading the title, abstract, maybe intro, and then going to the end. Why is that? The vanity of scientists, I think, is the main reason. The vanity, they want to check if you acknowledge their work. Maybe they've done something in that field. They want to check. Are you citing their papers? I think. Another reason for that maybe is they are looking for ideas. I told you a few weeks ago that it's not a good idea to look for ideas in papers. But some people are still doing it. So some people will read the conclusions and further work to see if they see something, maybe what you've done, you summarize all your contributions in the conclusion section. So they want to read it again. That's another reason. So now, having the number of pages per section, which parts of a paper are the most important? Remember that, and it's not vanity, it's just working on your careers. You want as many people as possible read your work, cite it, and know how to spell your name correctly, right? Especially with Polish names, they are difficult in the big picture, of course, in the world of science. You want to spread your discovery, your paper as widely as possible. So which parts of a paper are most important? I guess the ones that are read by many, many people. Yes. These are very important. All of them are important, but in terms of advertising your work, I guess the title is important, the abstract, introduction, conclusions. These are the sections that should be very well written. Some people read the details. That's also important, but these that are read by many people are especially important. They should be really written well. In terms of the title page, usually the first page in your paper has the title, authors, addresses, and abstract. Here there are many choices that you are facing. In the title, you can be very specific or very general. So the title can be a methodology creating stronger concrete based on chlorine, sulfate mixed with something, you know, a very, very specific title that says everything in just one sentence. It can be also more general, like saying a new concrete that is the strongest among all known concrete, right? Something very general without any details. It can be bold. If you remember the talk by Kenneth Holden, I think he was telling about a case, I forgot the details, where his boss asked him, Kenneth, do you think you're right? Yes, I think I'm right. Well, why don't we name the paper the structure of molecule is solved, right? Very bold title. Of course, there are risks, benefits, and risks to every choice that you are making. It all depends, right? So you are facing that choice. Anything is possible here. You have to be careful, of course. Don't be too bold. Be just bold, enough bold, but not too bold. Don't be too modest also. So somewhere is the ideal title that you should pick. Authors. The order of authors is important. You probably already know it, but if you don't, here it is. The first author is usually the person whose idea it is. The idea comes from that person. And it's an important position because when there are more than two authors, when there are two authors, they cite you Jones and Smith, 2023, right? When there are three authors, they say Jones et al. So Jones and other people, right? So if you are the Jones, it's a good idea to be first, because then your name will occur in many places. Typically, it's understood that the first author is the one whose idea it is. The last author in some discipline is the big guy or the big gal. The chief scientist in a lab, the big professor whose lab it is where you are working. In medicine, definitely, the last position is very honorable. It says who the big guy is. Right? That's, but not in every discipline. I don't think in computer science we have that, for example. I don't know about other technical disciplines. The last position is nothing special, but the first is very important. And the order usually is from the most to least contributions. So the order is important. And you have to sort it out. You have to fight it out among the people who work on the paper. And it's sometimes it's a touchy issue. My advisors, like I know that Herb Simon always did that. He didn't need to build his career anymore, at least. So he usually took the second, third, you know, last place. He didn't care that much. He let the students be the first authors. But it's perfectly fine for your advisor give the idea, come up with an idea, the solution, and even though you've done most of the work in terms of setting up the experiments, doing the measurements, even doing the writing, it's perfectly fine for you to be the second author. Because remember, the first author is definitely a person who's the most important in terms of the idea, intellectual contribution. But many professors, many advisors, and I've continued that thing that my advisors were doing. So I usually let the student be the first author when I have a paper with a student. But it's not necessarily so. So don't feel disappointed if you've done a lot of work and you are still the second author. Just think about it, you know, who the first author should be. And there is really no... no recipe on that. It's a matter of negotiation. If you feel that it was your idea and your advisor still pushes his or her name as the first name, well, have a gentle conversation. Conversation with the other authors can be two types, like this, or can be a gentle conversation. In my experience, gentle conversations are more effective in the long run. People who are very, confrontational, okay, maybe you get your way one time or two times, but the other people that you negotiate with are going to be harder next time. There is a book that I definitely recommend to you. It's, I forgot the authors, but it's... the title is Getting to Yes. It's a small book, a paperback, published by people who were conducting a project on the topic of negotiations at Harvard. They published that as a paperback, small book, Getting to Yes. I think it was published also in Polish. It was translated and published in Polish. The most important conclusion from that whole project was that every negotiation should end in a situation where all the sides of the negotiation feel that they got something, that they are winners, that they also got something from that negotiation. Somebody who is negotiating always like a tank, like a, you know, the big thing that rolls the roads, may win one time, but the next time that negotiation is going to be much more difficult for him or her. So if I come to you and say it's going to be the way I want it, what happens? The next time you are prepared for that. Next time I come to you like this, you will have other weapons to essentially get me off my tracks, right? And so it's not a good idea generally to be like that. But then you can say to your advisor, your co-authors, I feel that my contribution to this paper was significant. And I think I have I deserve to be the first author. You can say that, of course, very gently. If you hear arguments against that, the advisor tells you, the idea was from the very beginning mine, and you did this and that, you know, you have to accept that. But you can also try to get something out of that. Then you can say, well, we have another direction that we agreed on to do. Would it be okay for that paper to have my name as the first name, right? You can negotiate something. In any case, you should take care of yourself also with people that you work with. That's what I want to say here. It's a general principle. They say in Polish, na pochyłe drzewo nawet koza wskoczy. I will translate it into English, I'll try. When the tree is slanted, even a goat will climb it. That means essentially that you should take care a little bit of yourself. You should not always yield. So remember, the order is important. The first person gets the most credit, and you should also, of course, through your work first, right? Your ideas, your work, you should make it into being the first. But if you feel that you should be first, well, say it. Probably gently, but say it. Gently because your relationship with your advisor, your mentors, is a delicate relationship. It's almost like a marriage. It's a good comparison, but of course, marriage is forever. The relationship with your advisor is 4 years. If it's been a good relationship, it will stay. Trust me, it will stay for a long time. And you want to build a long-term relationship, not just 4 years. You want to have an advisor, your mentor, to be a person that you can call, you can send email, you can take that person out to dinner, visit, etc. You want to have a long-term relationship. That's why the very confrontational approach is not a very good idea, just like in marriage. Gentle, but also you should take care of you. In a marriage, too, you cannot always have your spouse the way, right? You should always also take care of your interests for the health of the relationship, just for the health of the relationship, not only your health, not only your gains. The same here. Delicate matter, but remember that you should also take good care of your interests. Affiliations and addresses, of course, how to contact you, your email address, and where you are. There are some funny things here. For a while in Poland, when you had double affiliation, they gave you half the points, which was ridiculous. That didn't prevent me from putting double affiliation, but that has changed, so I don't think it's a problem anymore. If you are affiliated with two institutions, put both. Like, you know, in ideas, put both, I think. Because that doesn't cost you anything. You give credit to your employer, and they can also brag about a paper being published by one of the people affiliated with us. Abstract should tell everything in as much as you can tell everything in 4 sentences, of course. So everything that is most important. And be very careful, of course, what you put in there. There will be more on abstract in a moment. Sometimes it doesn't listen to my... Oh, here it is. I skipped a slide. The abstract is a brief, standalone summary of your research. It is used when you submit your paper. The program committee at the conference will use it to decide who the reviewers are going to be. Very often it's organized in such a way that they put the titles and abstracts on some website where the reviewers can bid on the papers. As a reviewer, when you feel that you are competent to review a paper, you say, I want to review that paper, and that paper, and that paper. And the only thing that you have at that point is the abstract and the title. Usually they hide the body of the paper from the program committee.
Some people write it at the very end, and others at the very beginning. I write it at the beginning, and the reason for that is that I want it to be perfect. I write it in the beginning, and then every time I read my draft, I usually work in a cycle. Like the best time of my day is morning. When I wake up, sometimes I used to do it in bed, like, you know, before even brushing my teeth and taking shower, I would just stay in bed, get the paper next to me, and then a pen, and I would just work on that paper in bed, even. The best time of my day. Quiet, I'm very fresh, and so. Then I would read that abstract again, make some corrections with pen and paper. For some reason, working with pen and paper is, maybe I'm an old-timer, it's a matter of how you were taught to write. I was taught to write with a pen and paper. That's why it works best for me. There's also another reason for pen and paper being good, because you can look at the whole page. You can easily page through the paper. So you extend your short-term memory, your working memory. So I write it in the early on so that I can make it better and better each time I review the paper. Then I would review the paper, make corrections, and then I would go to a computer and bring in the changes, print it again, and then have another round, read it again on paper. So it should include the following background and significance: what is the problem and why it's interesting, methods and materials, how did you do it and what your solution achieves, what are the most important results, if possible, quantify your claims. My algorithm is on the average 63% faster than the best algorithm so far. The concrete I developed is 2.3 times stronger than the concrete based on whatever traditional method, the best concrete so far. What have you been able to demonstrate, quantify your claims? And you can also say, why did your approach work so well? Identify something that made the approach work so well. You see, a lot of information and only four sentences, sometimes five or six, but you see in journal articles, abstracts are not very long. It cannot be too long. Some people say that you shouldn't be using too many acronyms, except for really obvious ones. In computer science, here are some obvious abbreviations. FIFO, USB, GUI, AI is understood by many people. Usually no citations, usually. But sometimes when you build your paper on somebody's problem, somebody's idea, you may mention that that person. So these are not iron rules, just indications. Introduction, not very long, provides a motivation for the study. You state the nature and scope of the problem. You review the background, history of prior work with references, describe the problem and your contributions. Essentially make the reader want to read more, crave for more. There is really no correct or best approach. You can develop your own style because there are many ways of writing well. For some reason, it's slow and doesn't always listen to me. Okay, here we are. There is really a need for a good story. So start with an exposition of the problem. List approaches to solving it. It's really a review of relevant literature, what people have done so far. People who worked on this problem, you should give them good credit, generous credit. If you remember, I showed you that quote from Newton. He said, or he wrote at some point, "If I've seen any further, it was because I was standing on the shoulders of giants." He was calling the people before him giants, people very important, their contribution. It's a good idea to be generous. Sometimes I've seen people trying to belittle their predecessors. That's a bad idea, I think, really bad idea. Even if
if their contribution wasn't that great, say something nice, something neutral, something nice. Don't belittle them. Say something that acknowledges what they've done, and then you can say, this paper goes further or solves one aspect of the problem that has not been solved by Jones yet. Yes. So be generous. Why would you want to be generous? Many reasons, really. For example, they can be reviewers of your paper. How do they find reviewers, journal editor? Well, the journal editor looks at the title and abstract and then goes to the end, looks at the citations, at the references. There's a good chance that the editor will ask people who you are citing to review the paper, because there's a good chance that they know what you're writing about. So it's actually quite probable that people who have done work before you will be your reviewers. You don't want to insult them, you don't want to belittle them or make them feel like you are arrogant. So be generous. Another thing is, you are not alone. People have done work before you. Maybe it was harder for them to invent the problem, to make the first steps. So they actually deserve acknowledgement. So be generous. You can point out that the aspects that they have not looked at or they have not solved, that's okay. In any case, you should make it obvious that what you are doing is the next logical thing to do. It's part of the story. You describe the problem, what people have done, and it's obvious that this has to be done next. That makes a good story. It's one possible way of writing is to write it recursively. So the first sentence of every paragraph should set the spirit of the section. And the first paragraph should set the spirit. The first sentence of every paragraph should set the spirit of the paragraph. That's part of good writing. Say the most important thing. Idea, conveying the idea is very important. So you should use a simple language, just like you do in speaking, almost like as if you were explaining to somebody on a whiteboard. Sometimes we feel tempted to use wise language. Some people use those very sophisticated words. They want to sound like well-educated people. That's absolutely not necessary, and it's counterproductive. Use very, very simple language because you want people to understand, you want the article to read easily. So use simple language, almost as if you were writing to your grandmother, explaining your grandmother what you're doing. Intuition is the primary goal and not the secondary. If people understand, if they get the intuition of your work, they can follow the details much easier. The intuition is really very important. It's hard to develop intuition from the formal details. It may vary from discipline to discipline. Maybe in mathematics it's slightly different. The theorems and correct proofs are maybe more important than the intuition. I don't know. But in engineering, I think intuition is much more important. Probably in mathematics, I would also try to give the intuition in addition to the theorems and proofs. Even if the reader skips the details, with the intuition will stick. They will remember that. And they will take away something valuable from the paper. In the results, you should make generous use of tables and figures. The narrative, the written words, should just refer to the most important, most interesting elements of the tables and figures. If there is a figure in your paper, a table or a figure, it deserves a paragraph about it, some guidance through that table and figure. That was pointed out to me by one of the people, one of the professors in my department where I did my PhD. When he read, I think, a draft of my paper, he told me about this rule. Have a paragraph, at least, about every, for every paper, for every figure and table that you have. Sometimes people confuse results with conclusions. Results are just hard observations that you have. Conclusions may contain speculations. So results should be really as objective as you can make that. And you should also report all the details, especially in engineering, computing platform, processor, operating system, language, compiler version, for a computer scientist. Of course, in every discipline, there are details that people should get when reading your paper. The idea is the replicability. You want them to be able to replicate your results, to double check if they want to. Pay attention, of course, to the experimental validity of your results in every in empirical papers. Are your conclusions justified? Are they justified by the results of your paper, of your experiment? Conclusion is the place where you can express your opinions, guesses, interpretation of your results. So results are hard things. In the conclusions, in the discussion, you are allowed to speculate. You should compare your results to similar studies. This is the section where you should do that. Are they consistent with the previous results? If they are not consistent, explain why you think they are different. Again, without belittling the other people, but just explain why. Maybe the conditions were different, the situation was different, etc. So explain why, speculating, of course, why the results are different. And also future work. So outline the avenues for possible future research, because every paper is somewhat unfinished business. There are open problems still. It's just a progress report. Do not claim more than you did. Do not generalize from one result to everything. You can speculate in the discussion, but also be very careful. In your experiments, maybe it worked well on a few test cases. Don't claim it will work on everywhere. You just say on the data that scientists are very, very modest here. They say, when there is a result of an experiment, they say, it seems that, you know, and they do the conclusions. So very rarely they do use hard language. It seems, or our results indicate that, and then your conclusion, right? So be very, very modest here. Sometimes they say that you should use passive voice to be modest. That's a very poor way of being modest. I think modest is just not claiming more than you've done, describing your work in a modest way, but not necessarily using passive voice. I have a few slides about passive voice later on. I will come back to that. Acknowledging others does not diminish the credit that you will get from your paper, really. You should clearly explain what you have done. And if you acknowledge others, it will really not diminish from your work. The same, like, we will have a meeting about being a leader, having a lab, being a mentor yourself. Acknowledging the others is really not diminishing, taking away anything from you. If your lab has achieved a success as a boss of your lab, what should you say at the award ceremony? You should say, it's all because I have worked with some of the best people that I've ever worked with. If you remember Randy Pausch, he was doing that very generously. I've worked with wonderful people, right? He took them to Disneyland, I think, when he got tenure, right? Remember? So do that. It doesn't diminish anything. Everybody knows that you are the boss there, and it's all because of you. I'm kidding now, of course. But acknowledge others. If there is competition, other people working on in this field, say something like, "Is he expiring inspiring work or seminar work, breakthrough paper, use something nice. It doesn't make your paper weaker, really. You should also clearly say why, where your approach is weak. What are the weaknesses of your approach? Because every work has some weak spots. You should say it clearly where they are. If you fail to give credit to other people, that often is a killer. It will kill the paper. Why will it kill the paper? Outside of the of this personal grudges, like, you know, a reviewer thinks you should have acknowledged her or him, and you didn't do it. Outside of that, if you don't acknowledge others, maybe you didn't know about the existence of that work. That's bad. Or maybe you did know it, but you pretend it was your idea. That's really very bad. So that's really a reason for rejection. So you should be aware of the work before that, and you should state it clearly and acknowledge. In the acknowledgments, you should acknowledge all the funding sources. You must have seen it in the papers. This work was supported by a grant from the Foundation of the Polish Science, number this and this. Why do we do that? Well, somebody is managing that money. They gave the money to you. The way they report to the government, whoever is giving the money, the government, they write reports saying, based on our funding, we managed 500 million zloty. That resulted in 37 publications, 2 Nobel Prizes, etc. If they can write it, so nice. So they want to see acknowledgments in your papers. It costs you nothing, so you should absolutely do it. People who have helped you, even the secretary, even people who are cleaning the dishes, whatever work they've done, acknowledge them. Your spouse, you should, in your doctoral dissertation, on the first page, you should do something like that. You know, thank you for my husband, who was, I left him alone for many nights when I was in the lab, or your wife. Things like that. People will like it, and it's just a nice thing to do. It costs you nothing. Anonymous reviewers, even if you don't know who they are, there are ways of writing something nice for them. Sometimes, again, my vanity, a paper I reviewed and I gave some criticism of something, I pointed out some things, I would sometimes look in the proceedings, have they actually changed the paper the way I suggested, right? And it's nice to see that change, and it's nice to see, thank you for pointing that out, an error in the proof or something. So you should do it, because people will actually sometimes even look at that to see if you've listened to them. Okay, it's just a delay of my computer. References, you should cite papers. Citations are important because the reader can find where to look for more prior work. It's important for the authors of those papers. Citations are counted, and they contribute to the impact. It's called actually productivity metrics. That's a general name, like the what is it called? I score and age score.
Age score.
Age score. Yes. Yes. So that's calculated from citations. So it's important for the people whom you cite. You want to also be cited by other people. As far as style of citation goes, this is probably the best way of writing, is last name and year. The reason for that is that you don't need to page to the end of the paper to find out what 15 was, right? You can just see the name, and then if you are working in a field for years, you usually know who Jones is, and you know his 2001 paper. It's everybody knows it in that field. So much better way of citing. When you write, I would definitely recommend you writing using a typesetting system like LaTeX over writing in Word. I still write short documents in Word, but long papers, dissertations, absolutely LaTeX. And LaTeX has citation styles that you can choose. It's a matter of putting just some calls to macros in the beginning of the document, and it will change from numbers to last names easily. An important thing, don't add citations. Don't add citations to papers because others did. There's a paper that other people cite, then you add it too without reading it. You shouldn't do that. You should read the original papers before citing them and judge for yourself whether they should be cited. There is a little bit of game playing here, the vanity of scientists. Reviewers will sometimes suggest their papers to cite. Why would they do that? Well, that will increase their citations. It's a choice on your part whether to cite them or not. I remember Simon once, when he was explaining the way he works, he said he doesn't look for ideas in papers. I told you about that. So what he does is, when he has an idea, what he did, actually, he's dead now. When he had an idea, he got ideas from other places. Like he would have lunch with people in different disciplines once a week. Once a week he would go to lunch with somebody in a different discipline. And he would ask questions like, what's happening in your discipline these days? A conversation, what are the important topics? And he would sometimes have an idea how to make a contribution in that field. Then he would ask the friend, the colleague, can you give me a few important references to that field? That's saving a lot of time, right? The colleague in that discipline points out to a few important papers. And then he would go to a library for a week. Of course, the old-fashioned way of working in a library with papers, physical papers. After the week, he would know what the important contributions in the field are. And once he said, I remember, about citations, you know, after a week, I usually know who the important people are, who the important papers are to cite. And, you know, it happens occasionally that a reviewer will tell me to cite somebody else, but typically I was aware of those papers, but I decided not to cite them, right? So don't get intimidated by the reviewers, but sometimes they will point you out important papers, sometimes. Not necessarily their papers, somebody else's papers. So consider them, but don't just put them because everybody puts citations to those papers. Final check of the composition, the formatting requirements. Conferences usually have strict formatting requirements. Don't violate them. Like they tell you, the font should be minimal 10 point. Don't make it 9.5 just to fit more. Don't narrow the margins quietly. Follow the formatting requirements. Overall structure, how it reads, see if the introduction is not too weak, the conclusion is not too weak, there should be a conclusion, shouldn't just stop. See whether there is not too much, whether there are not too many words, look at the grammar. In general, perform a lot of rewrites, cycles, like you read, correct, type it into the computer, those changes, have a rest, a few hours, maybe a day, a rest, and then come back to it with a fresh mind. Many rewritings. It's important, I think. My first papers that I wrote as a doctoral student, I read them years later, and I was amazed how well I actually, how I perfected them, because I had like 30 cycles, like that. It's not unusual to have that many cycles, reading, correcting, and reading again. Visual structure is also important. So bullet points, sections, subsections.
Avoid too long paragraphs, too long sections, so visual. Nice formatting, whenever appropriate, italics, bold. Don't overdo it, but make it have some structure. Pictures are useful also, because they make the paper easier to read. These are two things from one of the papers I wrote with a student. We have both, actually, from in the same paper, a table with the results and a plot, a diagram. Some things are easier in the table. You see the exact values. But when you look at the diagram, you see the relative values, which are hard to imagine and see in the table. The same things. When you see this, you realize, oh boy, these authors, they really, their algorithm is really very, very good. You see that this is the error on the y-axis, and we have really reduced the error incredibly. It's visible on the plot. You can't see that here that easily. You would have to start using imagination. So these things make it easier to read the paper if you use diagrams. And tables are also useful because you can present the results in one place. There are some slides that I go very quickly. I promise to tell you a little bit about the passive voice. The short advice is never use passive voice. That's the short advice. The battle, at least in computer science, in English, happened decades ago, probably 50 years ago. I have seen very few papers written in passive voice. In other disciplines, I don't know really, but writing in passive voice is not a good idea in English. If you write your document in Word, you will notice that Word actually underscores passive voice, points out to you, change it. In Polish, it's very conservative. There are still people who write in passive voice, whether they write in English or in Polish. It really is ugly. In English, it's just ugly. So instead of it can be seen that we can see that active voice. Active voice parses much easier. We understand it when reading easier, and it's more clear. Whenever I'm in a talk in our department, thesis defense, master's thesis, or PhD, when I hear the experiment was conducted in Polish, zrobiono, I always raise my hand, either in the beginning or at the end. Excuse me, I just wanted to clarify. You said the experiment was conducted. Who did that? Was it you, your friend, your wife, your husband? I just wanted to make it clear. Typically, the answer is, I did it. I say, why don't you just say I did it, right? Just say it. If I were to lie, suppose I ask my wife very nicely to write a paper for me or do an experiment for me, I would write in the paper, the experiment was conducted, I wouldn't be even lying, right? It's unclear. You can hide things behind it. Just don't do it. And it also reads harder. Oops. Maybe the battery is getting really weak. Okay, here it is. Sorry, there are a few slides in Polish. I just, those of you who are Polish, who know Polish, may find it useful. That's just a citation from somewhere. The link is here. That person advocates a passive voice, actually impersonal, I think. I cannot say, and then the motivation is modesty. I think it's a ridiculous way of being modest, really ridiculous way to write passive or voice or personal. When you, did I skip something? I may have skipped something accidentally. Maybe I should just press, this is another, it skipped a page. I found it somewhere else. a lady in Poznań, I think, she actually advocated using active voice, which is, so in Polish also, I'm not the only one really, that advocates active voice rather than passive voice. Sometimes people write plural even though there's a single author. That sounds funny, really. There's a single author and then they say, we did something, right? The question is, who was this person working with? And maybe it's the pluralis majestatis, that's a Latin term. You know, the kings would say, by God's grace, the King of England, right? We don't use that anymore. We don't do that. The pluralis majestatis. So if you are the only author, just say I. Sometimes I had a difficulty with this I in two cases. One case was that I was working with my advisor. Let's say my dissertation. I'm the only one of my dissertation, right? The only author. Writing in a chapter, I did something, while actually I worked with my advisor and we published even a paper together on that thing. I had a difficulty writing I. So then I would try to fiddle around, like I would say with my advisor, or I would use maybe impersonal language. I just didn't want to claim more than I actually did. That was one situation. And then I think it jumped again, the slide. It's not even the remote, it's the computer's reacting slowly. So sometimes it's difficult. So I cannot say that I never ever use passive voice. Sometimes I do when there's a situation in which I find it difficult to use first person. Tenses are important. Don't mix tenses. A present tense is stronger than future, and past makes it a little bit like a diary. So present tense is probably the best to use. I press, I'm waiting, but nothing happens. Just use this. Try not to use abbreviations. Is it one? Yes. Abbreviations. Oops. I don't know why it's happening. Try not to use abbreviations. Some people use a lot. I try to use not too many of them. There's a nice article that you can find. I hope it's still there. I think Patterson is retired. I think he's still alive. He works, at Berkeley. Very well-known fellow in computer science. You can read it yourself. Have a few slides summarizing the important things that he said about writing. I think it's a good advice. Read aloud what you have written, because sometimes when you read aloud, only then you will notice that some transition between sentences doesn't read very well. And you want the reader to read your paper easily, nicely. So reading aloud is a good idea. That reminds me of when I was reading the scriptures in the church when I was a teenager, a child, and I remember the advice in the course, that I took a course on that, was to actually read aloud, not quietly, read aloud that piece of the scripture at home before you actually read it in the church. A very good idea, very good advice, because only when you read aloud, you will notice that some combinations of words are hard to read. The same here. They are hard to read for the reader, and you will notice it when you read it aloud. Good advice, I think. The structure, the paragraph. He's saying that a paragraph should be about single idea and a single key topic sentence, and then maybe working it out. He recommends this book, and I knew of this book before I read Patterson's advice. It's a very tiny paperback that has the most important elements of the English language of writing. Typical mistakes and the most important elements, advice on how to write correctly. Definitely recommend it. I probably have one in my office. If you want to ever see it, just let me know, and I'll be happy to lend it to you. I think, no, I don't think there is a Polish translation, but it's for people writing in English, so you have to use the English original version.